Talking History, the radio voice of the Organization of American Historians. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. He was a devout Calvinist who believed God had predestined him to wipe out slavery. He was not insane. He was the most forward-looking white reformer of his era on the issue of race. Had it not been for the Transcendentalists, he may have been forgotten by history. And without him in the picture, the Civil War may not have happened when it did. These are just a few of the conclusions reached by our guest this week, David Reynolds, in his new book, John Brown, Abolitionist, The Man Who Killed Slavery, Sparked the Civil War, and Ceded Civil Rights. I'll be speaking with David Reynolds in a few minutes, and after that we'll continue our special series of readings from the unpublished recollections of Civil War soldier T.V. Brown. But first, let's look at an item of historical interest in the news on the Civil War that you may have missed. The recent marking of the anniversary of Quantrill's raid on Lawrence, Kansas, sparked comments that remind us that the legacy of the Border War continues. 142 years ago, this past August 21st, William Quantrill and more than 300 Missouri ruffians, as they were known, rode into Lawrence, Kansas, murdered 85 men, and set fire to all but a few homes and businesses. As an article in the Lawrence Journal World on the anniversary date reports, for Lawrencians then and now, Quantrill personified evil. In and around 1863, certainly if you lived in Lawrence, you lived in fear of Quantrill. He was the devil incarnate, said Virgil Dean, editor of Kansas History, our Journal of the Central Plains, and director of publications for the Kansas State Historical Society. On the other side of the state line, however, Donald Hale, president of the William Quantrill Society, defended Quantrill. He was a savior to a lot of people, Hale said. He stood up for Missourians. He kept the Jayhawkers from riding roughshod in Missouri. Hale went on to remind us that 2 years before, on September 25, 1861, a group of free staters from Kansas wreaked havoc on Osceola, Missouri. They literally destroyed the town. They set fire to every building, commented Richard Sunderwith, an Osceola native. They didn't kill everybody, but they had a mock trial, and they ended up executing 9 men in the town square. When they left Osceola, it was in ruins, and really, it has never been the same. Sunderwith continued, so around here, people tend to think there was some justification to Quantrill's going into Lawrence. More on the Civil War when we return with our guest, David Reynolds. This is Talking History. In this age of terrorism, there are few historical figures as intriguing as John Brown, the controversial abolitionist who used terrorist tactics against slavery. The case of John Brown in our post-9/11 world reminds us that we're not the first generation to ask, when does principled resistance become anarchic brutality? And how can a murderer be viewed as a heroic freedom fighter? These and other related questions are prompted by our reading of an excellent new biography, John Brown, Abolitionist, The Man Who Killed Slavery, Sparked the Civil War, and Ceded Civil Rights, by David S. Reynolds, Distinguished Professor of English and American Studies at the Graduate Center and Baruch College of the City University of New York. Welcome, David.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here, Brian.
Right. Good to have you. Why don't you start us off by giving us a little information on John Brown's childhood and even early adult life up to the point he becomes an abolitionist.
John Brown was born in 1800 in Torrington, Connecticut, and was taken at an early age to live in the Ohio wilderness. It was at the age of 12 where he was on a trip for his father, he witnessed a slave boy being beaten with a shovel. He had gotten close to this boy. He was a very intelligent young boy. And John Brown was totally outraged that this boy not only was beaten, but also was sent out into the cold to sleep. while John Brown, as a white boy, was coddled at the table and so forth. And at that point, he swore eternal war against slavery, according to his autobiography. He went on, he became a tanner, a farmer, he was married twice, because his first wife died in childbirth, and he had a total of 20 children, although only 9 of them outlived him.
So many children, it's when he had time for anything.
Yeah.
Does this have anything to do with the fact that he failed at so many things?
Yeah, right. He succeeded as a reproducer, that's for sure. But, you know, there are a few influential people in history who have failed in so many different areas. He failed as a tanner, a shepherd, a wool distributor, a real estate speculator, just to name a few of the things he failed at. He went bankrupt and he was sued by creditors. To explain this, he lived in a time when America was making a huge transition from the subsistence economy of the past, where people lived off the land, to the capitalist economy that we know today. And because of his growing family, he felt he had to enter the capitalist economy, but he did so in 1837, precisely the wrong year. That was the year of the economic panic. And actually, a lot of the real estate that he had invested in at that time, if he'd been able to hang on to it, he would have been quite wealthy later on. But it was a very bad moment. Also, he was extremely bullheaded in his approach to business. He would set prices for his wool. My high-grade wool is worth this much, and my low-grade. And he wouldn't bend with the marketplace. And you just can't be that way either in his day or in our day. You have to be able to bend a little bit. And he was a little inflexible. And as a result, he ran into a lot of business problems.
His first involvement with the abolitionist movement was with the Underground Railroad. Tell us about that.
Well, from a very early age, his family was distinguished by its lack of racism. And not only that, but both in Connecticut and Ohio was a stopping off place on the Underground Railroad. And John Brown regularly took fugitive blacks into his house. And then when the Fugitive Slave Law was passed in 1850, he actually organized something he called the League of Gileadites, which was a very militant group of blacks. And he armed them. He got rifles for them. And the understanding was that if they were attacked, they would protect each other and they would shoot their pursuers. So it was an extremely militant version of the Underground Railroad.
Did he actually carry out much violence?
At that time, no. He actually had been a conscientious objector, hadn't gone into the military when he was young on moral grounds. And even though he did arm this group of blacks, nothing kind of came of that. It was only when he went to Kansas that the violence exploded.
Well, let's talk about that, because he's best known, obviously, for his raid on Harper's Ferry. But Pottawatomie, Kansas is certainly an important episode. So tell us what happened there.
John Brown had gone to Kansas with his sons to try to prevent it from becoming a slave state. It was wavering between slave and free. And he was fighting against pro-slavery forces. But a series of events by pro-slavery aggressors drove him to this extreme violent action at Pottawatomie, where around midnight he took 5 pro-slavery settlers out of their cabins and he slaughtered them with swords, with broadswords. It was a shocking event. However, it's never been really put fully into context. Not only was he responding against the sack of Lawrence and these kind of pro-slavery aggressions, but people don't realize that of the 36 political murders that took place between 1855 and 1858, 28 of those were committed by the pro-slavery side, only 8 by the anti-slavery side. Of those 8, John Brown did commit 5. But as a journalist said at that time, John Brown has brought Southern tactics to the Northern side.
He was never arrested for that.
No, I mean, there was a warrant out for his arrest, and it was kind of in the local papers. It was known that he'd done this, but Bleeding Kansas was in such chaos, and the legal system was very ambiguous. No, he was not arrested.
Okay. Again, as I mentioned earlier, he's best known for his raid on Harper's Ferry. Briefly summarize what happened at Harper's Ferry.
He hoped to raid a slave quarter, liberate the slaves in the area, and with these liberated blacks, retreat to the mountains, which he knew well from having been a surveyor, and use the mountain chain that ran very deep into the deep south as natural protection against pursuing forces, as his ever-growing army of liberation periodically made raids on other plantations and created a state of terror on the south so that eventually the south would say, we want to compromise. This is becoming ridiculous. And it wasn't as crazy a plan as a lot of people thought, but what actually happened is that he stalled. He did very easily took over Harper's Ferry. That was no problem, and he liberated the slaves in the area. But he stalled, and the reason he stalled is that he had an idealistic belief that it would be like the Nat Turner Rebellion, where it would just explode like wildfire. All these people would join him. All these liberated slaves would just flock and fight. But for a lot of the slaves, they weren't well prepared enough, and so these white people showing up at midnight and saying, "You're free," it's like a Martian just walked into the room. So, you know, for years they've been degraded, and suddenly, oh, we're free. So a lot of them were a little bit confused, I think very understandably confused.
Right.
As a result, he stalled, and because he stalled, he was captured.
Oh, well, that's a good point, because in most short textbook accounts, this is painted as something doomed from the start, a program or a project that simply was ill-conceived, but yet you indicate that it did make some sense and there was some opportunity there for success.
There was some real opportunity for success, because we even know today how that relatively tiny group of Afghan guerrillas withstood the tremendous Soviet army by using the mountains. We know that up to this date, I mean, who knows what's going to happen tomorrow, but Osama bin Laden and certain of his followers have evaded our vastly superior technology and so forth. It wasn't really a crack-brained scheme. He had seen it work in Haiti, in the West Indies, where the Maroons fled to the mountains and drove out the colonial empire there. The scheme was not crazy. It was just that he stalled, and he got trapped. I think if he had escaped, if he had done what he originally said, which was to plant these kind of cells, terrorist cells, he didn't call them that, but groups all along the Appalachians, he might have been able to really stir up a lot of chaos in the South. Whether it would have caused the fall of slavery, who knows. But he certainly could have easily created a lot of chaos.
Okay. Well, either way, success or failure, this certainly put him on the map. As a result of this, he was one of the top two or three most prominent men in the country.
At that time, he was. The only reason he was prominent, though, is that he wasn't killed during the raid. The guy that stabbed him had picked up his dress sword instead of his military saber. If he had died, it would have been like Waco or Ruby Ridge, that kind of thing, or Oklahoma City at most. But because he lived, Henry David Thoreau said that Brown's words were much more powerful than his rifles. He lived, and he was in prison for a couple of months, and all these reporters, even though they hated him, most of them were pro-slavery reporters, they reprinted his words. His words went throughout the world, and Emerson said that his speech to the Virginia court was as great as the Gettysburg Address in its eloquence. So it was through his verbal eloquence that he made such a huge impact. And the South, which initially had praised him, obviously the South hated him, but they liked these macho guys, suddenly said, "No, wait a minute, we have to stop." And the North, which originally had damned him, when Emerson came along and said, "This guy is as great as Jesus Christ," suddenly said, maybe there's something in this guy. Yeah, he became an incredibly polarizing figure, and that's why I say he helped to spark the Civil War.
Yet over time, in the next century or so, his star begins to sag a bit or to flag, and in the textbooks he takes up less and less space. Why do you think that was the
case? What happened is that after the collapse of Reconstruction in 1876, there was a long period of Jim Crow and Ku Klux Klan segregation until 1954 with the Brown v. Board of Education. And it was during that period that not just most people, but even historians who so much shared the conservative view, demonized John Brown. And so they only talked about Potawatomi and his kind of crazy fanatical side and all of that. They did not highlight his racially progressive side. So he virtually sank from view. And wherever he emerged, it was kind of as this wild-eyed fanatic type. And it's only the civil rights movement that has brought about a certain partial recuperation of his image. I hope my book restores him to a very central place in American history where I think he should be. I hope that more and more he does, as a result of my research and that of a few others, gets back to where he should be as one of the real movers and shakers and one of the prophets of American history.
Yeah, I think your book will do that, and certainly the reviews are putting it in that direction. But let's just clarify. So you don't think he was mad or a fanatic?
No. I mean, he's been psychoanalyzed to death. Some people call him paranoid. Recently, someone called him manic depressive. Someone else said bipolar. I read every letter that I can get my hands on that he wrote. The only time he was really depressed, and I think any one of our listeners would be depressed and almost suicidal, was when I mentioned his children dying. And within 2 weeks, four of his children died at once as a result of scarlet fever. And at that point, he says, "I really feel like dying now." But that was back way before Harper's Ferry. I mean, as I say, I dare say anybody would feel a little bit depressed then. But really, in general, his letters, when he was in jail, he slept like a baby. His lawyer tried to bring up insanity defenses. If I felt that way, I would take it. I'm not insane. And I believe him. I really don't see the kind of symptoms of insanity there. except for that one moment of depression when those four children died back in 1842.
Well, we're all allowed those moments. You mentioned earlier Osama bin Laden, and you made reference to people like Timothy McVeigh. Was John Brown a terrorist, and was he similar to these people in any way?
Well, McVeigh made John Brown a hero of his, and the abortion doctor killer Paul Hill venerated John Brown. John Brown's been compared to Osama bin Laden. I would say that we can call John Brown a terrorist, but what Doris Lessing calls a good terrorist, I know that sounds like an oxymoron, but I say that because he was facing a situation where the most evil institution in American history, slavery, seemed to be cemented in place by law, by custom, by ideology. Even Abraham Lincoln said before the war, I think it's going to take 100 years for slavery to disappear. So I think that in this case, his particular brand of selective terrorism was justified, and also he happened to be a very American terrorist. He was a very strict Calvinist himself, but among his closest followers were Jews, atheists, agnostics, African Americans. He was very close to Native Americans. To me, he was every bit as religious as supposedly Osama bin Laden is, but not as closed. His journey was toward openness and toleration, not toward closure. Bin Laden would love to establish a Muslim theocracy in which alternative views are excluded. John Brown was headed in exactly the opposite direction.
Right. I suppose I should ask this up front, but did you start writing this book before 9/11 or after?
I started the research before it, but 9/11 certainly put a certain inflection on it, to be sure,
So you were going to do it anyway, but this one kind of prompted you along.
Absolutely.
And did it steer the course of your writing and thinking?
Well, the last chapter, I mean, if you read my last chapter, and even other parts of the book as well, you know, Waco and Ruby Ridge and a few other things had happened, but that kind of crystallized a lot of ideas for me. So to be sure, the second half of the book is definitely with 9/11 in mind.
Well, I think whatever you set out to do in terms of changing people's opinion of John Brown is going to happen. The reviews I read, and we talked about a few of them before we started the interview, are definitely headed in that direction. So good job and congratulations.
Thank you, Brian. It's wonderful to be here.
I've been speaking with David S. Reynolds, Distinguished Professor of English and American Studies at the Graduate Center and Baruch College of the City University of New York, and the author of John Brown, Abolitionist, The Man Who Killed Slavery, Sparked the Civil War, and Ceded Civil Rights.
October 16, 1859, peace is hanging by a small thin line. The clouds of war are low and dark, waiting for someone to light the spark. Marching through the valley and along the ridge, crossing to Virginia on the river bridge, they reached Harper's Ferry and they circled round. Great God Almighty, it's old John Brown. Tighter than the barrel of his 45, John Brown waited for the slaves to rise with his long, sharp rifles and his Navy coat.
As promised, we now continue with our reading of excerpts from Recollections of Field Hospital Service During the War of Secession by T.B. Brown. A German immigrant who joined the U.S. Army before the Civil War, Brown became a hospital steward and remained in the Army for 3 decades. He wrote his recollections in 1894. We pick up the story at the Battle of Fredericksburg, a battle that lasted 3 days from December 13th to the 15th, 1862. Brown's unit, the 3rd Infantry, was held on reserve at the village of Falmouth until noon of the third day. Brown writes of the unit's coming under fire while attempting to cross the Rappahannock River. Thank you.
I was at this time mounted on a horse, and was quietly following the regiment. The second shot struck the ground about 100 yards to my right, glanced off, and came sailing so slowly that I could plainly note its length and shape. The next shot, a 6-pounder, was not so harmless. It went through the left thighs of Private Beverly and Knopfmacher, and served to illustrate most vividly the important role played by constitution and temperament. Beverly was of Irish birth, about 35 years old, small, thin, and cadaverous of appearance, and a sufferer from asthma. Knopfmacher was a German, about 25 years old, stout and healthy. Had I been asked which of these two men would die from the shock, and which would go on to convalescence without a hitch, I should have unhesitatingly answered that Beverly would die and Knopfmacher live, but it was quite otherwise. The road over which we were marching was at this point raised about 2 feet, and the embankment thus formed afforded considerable shelter, and behind this shelter the two wounded men were laid. I at once anesthetized Beverly, who had not lost consciousness, and in a few minutes the surgeon of some of the other regiments had removed the shattered thigh. We then gave our attention to Knopfmacher, and with the greatest difficulty brought him back to sufficient consciousness to warrant the administration of chloroform, and soon his thigh also was removed, but in vain. The poor fellow never rallied. Beverly, we learned in time, made an excellent recovery. On this day I was at my best, and it gives me pleasure to remember how I sat on my newly acquired horse with pipe in mouth, cool as a cucumber. We were marched under the very muzzles of the rebel guns behind Fredericksburg, and throwing out one company, of which 13 were killed, as pickets, the remainder of the regiment took station behind a brick tannery which covered an entire block. We were now in no danger from the enemy's artillery, whose guns could not be depressed sufficiently to annoy us, but the rebel sharpshooters were extremely alert, and it was sufficient to go to the corner of the tannery and thrust out one's hat to have it perforated with bullets. Private Drake, one of our pickets, was shot through the neck. He fell, but soon staggered to his feet and struck out for the tannery, the rebel sharpshooters using him as a target. While crossing a ditch in front of the tannery, he was hit again, and he fell into the ditch, and still the sharpshooters kept pegging away at him. After a few minutes, he again staggered to his feet, and looked about him in such a dazed and pitiful way that flesh and blood could stand it no longer, and some of the men ran out and helped him in amid a shower of bullets, none of which, fortunately, took effect. At about 10 o'clock that night, Dr. Hall came to me with the information that he had found a grocery store about 2 blocks away that would just suit as a hospital for our wounded, and without asking permission to do so, we carried our 6 wounded men from the tannery to this house. Placing these on the carpeted floor of what had evidently been the parlor, we were made happy by finding abundance of flour, cornmeal, and other delicacies, and soon enjoyed a fine meal. One of the wounded, who was shot through the head, soon died, and after closing his eyes and crossing his hands over his breast, we covered him with his blanket and left him as he was, with the intention of digging a grave for him in the little garden beside his house in the morning. I had been reading by the light of the open fireplace about an hour, when the stillness was broken by a blow against the door in the other end of the room, and looking around, I was horrified to discover that the supposed dead man had attempted to leave the room, had struck his head against the door, and was now dead sure enough. It did not take me long to reason out the true state of the case. The man was not dead when laid out, and his jumping up and accidentally butting his head against the door was the result of the muscular spasm during the real death struggle. Still, my novel lost its interest after that experience, and I went to bed. Thank you.
listening to David Jones, a graduate student in the theater program at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, reading from T.V. Brown's Recollections of Field Hospital Service During the War of Secession. Our thanks to the Clendenning Library of the University of Kansas Medical Center for their permission to use the unpublished manuscript. If you missed the previous segments in this series, you can find them at oah.org. Click on Talking History and on the shows which aired from September 19th through October 10th. This is Talking History. That's it for another week of Talking History. As always, we welcome your comments on this show and suggestions for future programs. Just send them to us either by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Fiona Beatty, producer, Alex Smith, our studio engineer. We remind you that the opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect those of the Talking History staff or of the OAH, and that for more information on Talking History or the OAH, visit our website at oah.org. Until next time, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.